getting sober requires a lot more than mind over matter, a lot more than willpower. It's about leveraging the support around you. People in recovery typically need a mix of medical help, emotional support, and changes in lifestyle to manage their addiction, not just mental determination. As both a therapist and someone embracing the recovery lifestyle, there's one tool I always recommend to people needing extra accountability: SoberLink. SoberLink is a high-tech breath analyzer system designed to help you get and stay sober. And here's why I love it. You'll test the same day every day, eliminating testing anxiety. Friends and family receive instant test results, helping you rebuild trust and preventing relapse. Accountability is a part of that, and it's something to really be embraced. Devices have built-in facial recognition, so your support circle knows you're testing, and tamper-resistant sensors flag any attempts at trying to beat the system, so your sobriety is never questioned. So let 2024 be your best year yet. Visit soberlink.com/TAM to sign up and receive $50 off your device. That's soberlink.com/TAM. And let accountability be your guide. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Addicted Mind Podcast. My name is Dwayne Osterlund. I'm your host, and we are on to the next episode. So today, our guest is Cesar Verme. He is the author of the book, The Powers of Addiction, Finding Freedom in Acceptance and Recovery. Today, Cesar is going to share his personal story of overcoming addiction, overcoming alcoholism, and the steps that moved him forward, and how acceptance was a big part of that process. He's going to share a little bit about his own life of overcoming the loss of his mother at a young age and his own battle in this addiction. Cesar reflects on his mission to support others and spread hope through sharing his own story. He really wants to inspire individuals to seek happiness and fulfillment, and for them to know they are not alone in this journey and to get help. So I think you'll get a lot out of this episode. And if you're getting a lot out of the Addicted Mind podcast, please rate and review us on iTunes. It really does help the podcast get found. I really do appreciate it. And don't forget to click the subscribe button so you get the latest episodes. All right, everyone, let's start this episode. All right, everyone, welcome to the Addicted Mind podcast. I have Cesar Verme with me, and he is the author of The Powers of Addiction, Finding Freedom in Acceptance and Recovery. Cesar, introduce yourself, and we're just going to jump right in.
Great. Well, thanks, Dwayne, for having me. Very excited to be here with you. So, as you mentioned, I just recently published a book, and if you had told me, I don't know, 5 or 10 years ago that I've been publishing a book, I would say you're crazy. There's no way. Crazy. I've never been a great student or never aspired to be an author. But as we were talking a little bit before, I've had my journey of addiction, and that really, when reflecting, started early on in my life. But then, as I was fortunate enough to get sober, and over the last 9 years, I've been sober a little over 9 years, it's been really interesting just to, when I began opening up a little bit about my situation with others, I start realizing the power that it, you know, we have to help others in similar situation. Because for many years, I've had a lot of bias, a lot of shame. Sure. So I kept inside, but my wife, she's been, you know, super helpful throughout my journey. And she is always a reminder saying, hey, you found always that someone that you're able to connect earlier in your journey and may have unlocked all these possibilities. So you got to be that person, hopefully, for others. And that was a big, big factor of that. And I'm just hoping that, you know, the book can be a vessel to many or a path, just as, you know, your podcast is to several.
Well, let's jump into a little bit of your story.
Yeah.
Because you have some tragedy in the beginning of your life. And then you talk about, you know, in your career, just being empty and, you know, almost like just a, you know, as they say, kind of a hole in your soul. So let's jump in there and we'll start there.
Yes. So it was interesting. Yeah, I lost my mom really young. I was about 12 years old when she passed. She was going for a procedure that wasn't expected to be anything that turned out to be. And unfortunately, she passed. And as you can imagine, learning, you know, losing someone that early on was very, very impactful, especially my mom. We're super close. As you may have seen from the book, I wasn't that close to my dad. And I never dealt that great with that. I start suppressing a lot of feelings. We're in a household where sharing emotions, sharing feelings wasn't the norm. So I became very good about hiding things, suppressing things. And as you know, somehow that transpired some shape or form. But that has led into, you know, a lot of behavior, risk-taking, and so on that continued to escalate throughout my career and my personal journey. So, and I was always a partier in a way growing up too. So, and growing up, my household, my dad is an alcoholic. So drinking was always part of it. And so to me, that was, you know, that what you do every day, right? That's how you do. So the partying always involved a lot. And I drank daily or almost daily from a very early age. And that just continued to evolve and progress and progress. And it's interesting your point about my career, because thankfully I'm being very successful. I never lost a job somehow, even though at times I probably should have or definitely could have. But it's interesting that a lot of times people looking from the outside, and a lot of people that I know that have read the book or that I've opened up to, they had no idea. No idea. Because you have experienced this. We become very good at hiding things and very good at pretending. And so you live this double life that is a little bit scary, how far you can get away with it. And I was able to keep it for so long. So yeah, it's very, very eye-opening to many when you hear that.
Yeah, you tell a story in your book about, in one of your relapses, about you're going to go to go-karts. And you stopped and you got all this wine and you drank it, but there was no drinking at this event.
Yeah.
And how you... Well, I'll let you tell it a little bit about how you, like you said, the deception, you know, just deceiving, keeping this so hidden and a secretive and going along, and how you, I think someone said something about heat stroke and you jumped on it.
Jumped on it. Yeah. Yeah. You're exactly right. It was a day where I was about, if I'm not mistaken, about 6 months sober or so. And I just had done a physical. And I got a bad cholesterol result. And then that was my trigger, because I was, you know, I stopped drinking for a little bit. I was doing better. So I said, well, in my eyes, this result's going to be great. Right. Because I kicked everything. And it wasn't. So that was the trigger where I said, well, and start going to the self-pity. And anyway, that led me to go on the way to the meeting. It was a team outing. I decide, well, let me go to Publix and get some boxed wine or whatever the case may be. And then I start drinking on the way to the go-kart. There was a meeting, and then after to the go-kart. So before the meeting, during, right just before. And then in between the races, I was going to my car and drinking more. That was parked there right next door. So, and then eventually caught up, where I drank quite a bit, and people realized, wow, you know, Caesar, something's up and something's not good. And to your point, someone said, well, so South Florida was very hot, and someone mentioned heat stroke. So that was the perfect opportunity. So I jumped at it. Everyone bought it. They even called the EMS and they came. They checked. I was okay. They realized you don't have any heat stroke. What's really going on? Then I told them at the ambulance, said, hey, don't tell anyone, but I just been drinking. And, you know, during that time, then they called my wife and she came to get me. And that was one of the steps that drew me closer to get the help I needed and really start that process. But yeah, that's a great example where you just, you're so good at hiding. People never jump into that thought. They would imagine almost anything else before they go there.
Yeah, which is, you know, you think about it and you start to share the story. I mean, you went all in there. I mean, all the way to the ambulance coming, all the way to this, but, and how to keep the addiction secret, to keep it silent. I mean, is that, and I don't think you're alone in that story when we talk about addiction, but you bring it up in a way to show how far we can go for self-deception and the deception of others.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a great point, because now when I read back what I wrote and as I was editing the book, and it's like, wow, I can't believe that was me. I can't believe it's almost like another person that I'm relooking, because to your point, when I was living it, it made sense, because you justify everything I did was planning how I'm going to get the next drink. So I planned my entire day as to how I'm going to get those breaks, to get an excuse to get out and get a drink. And then to also, as you mentioned, whenever someone challenges or in a situation where you think you may be getting exposed, I used to default to denial and usually worked. And when you did, you still deny, and it usually goes away. So it is amazing how far you go with it and how you're able to justify when you're in that mental state that it makes sense. You, just because you had a good day or a bad day, or is justifiable, or is not a lot because you're still functioning, right? Hey, you know, I still have a job. My liver results are not that bad on my medical, so I must not be drinking that much, right? So yeah, I was grabbing whatever I could.
So any way you could justify it, when did it start to kind of crumble? I mean, you had this event and then other things. When did it really start to say, okay, I got to break through this denial? Or how did you start to, I mean, I don't know if we really say that. I think sometimes the situations, it's forced upon us, but yeah, talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. Yeah, looking back, there are a few things. I think number one was seeing the disappointment in my wife, because there were some points where she said, I even don't recognize anymore. And she was, you know, she was confused, because she knew something wasn't right. She just wasn't sure what it was, because I always drank when we met. I was always relatively a big drinker. But as my drinking evolved, I was hiding a lot. So she had an insight of what, you know, a tenth or so what I was drinking. And so in her eyes, there wasn't it. There must have been somewhere, something else. But start seeing the disappointment when I made promises to her that I couldn't keep. Just as simple as making in time for an appointment that she could go. We had a newborn and she could go get her haircut and I could be there for her. And so that was a big factor. Another factor was when you start having physical reactions where you sometimes had the shakes and would wake up and I would need to have a drink or something just to kind of feel semi-normal. And I knew, say, okay, this is not good. This is not right. And then I think finally I was really going back to my own childhood where I recall the pain, the pain and the lack of safety of growing in a household where you wasn't sure how your dad's going to come, if he's going to come sober or drunk and what you're going to get today. And I realized that I was doing that for my daughter, to my daughter, and she was a 2, 2.5. And that was really my thing where I looked myself in the mirror, said, man, you're doing exactly what you have anger and you despise your dad for. And I said, I'm better than this. I got to do something different. And that's where I started my journey.
Yeah. And you saw yourself, you connected to the pain. You saw yourself as almost as a child, and here you have a newborn, and you're like, whoa, I can't do this. So how did you start? What was the first thing you did?
Yeah. Yeah. So that was a process too. It wasn't a linear and simple decision. But I think just kind of opening up to that, saying, hey, I may have a problem, and then starting doing research. So in my case, I end up going to AA meetings where I open up to my wife, Laura, and I said, listen, I know I have a problem. I want to get help. And so I researched AA, and so I found one place close to where I used to live and started going. And then you may have heard this from other of your guests or your own experiences, that I was like, well, man, I may not be quite perfect, but these people really messed up.
These people, I'm not that bad.
They have a problem. I'm not that bad. So then, of course, I went through this journey when I wasn't quite sold on the entire process, or the fact that, hey, I cannot have another drink. What really kind of scared me from going to AA meetings is that they say you can never have another drink again. I said, how is that possible? That scared me to have that. So really, that was a journey. I tried everything. I relapsed a few times trying to, prove to myself that I could do it. And I realized that I can't. I just can't drink. And then really it was, to me, the turning point was when I really acknowledged internally and I accepted that, hey, you just can't do it. You just cannot do it. And the moment that I accepted that and acknowledged that to myself, that was it. Then thankfully, everything started falling in place.
Talk about that more, when you started to accept it, because that's a big part of your story.
Yeah. Yes. Because I think it goes... In my experience was that just as I put myself in not pedestal, but better than the ones around AA or other addicts, is because I had a lot of shame. I had a lot of bias. I had a lot of fear. And I think that was kind of a little bit of the challenges that I have, that I knew that I needed help. I knew that I was drinking too much, but it was easier to keep going and doing what I was doing because I was comfortable, right? I didn't have to face something and really hold myself accountable. But as we discussed, things evolved and so on. And really, the interesting thing is once it was my last relapse and I was sober for a few months as well, and then I relapsed because I got a new job, right? I was expecting a call. I got a call that I couldn't answer, got a voicemail, and the voicemail wasn't necessarily that warm when I could hear. So I immediately defaulted, well, you didn't get this job. And then again, I went to that self-pity and start drinking because I said, well, you lost this great opportunity, blah, blah, blah. So I start drinking. Then I had the courage to call that person back. She answered and then said that I have the job, made me the offer. So then, of course, I started drinking because I got the job. So let's party.
It's like, well, I might as well drink now. I mean, I got the job, so I was going to lose a job. I might as well drink. And now I got the job, so I might as well drink, right?
Exactly. Exactly. And then so went all day long. And then I was about to head home. And I called Laura, my wife. And as soon as she answered the phone and I said, hi, she knew that I had a drink or several. And she asked me, did you drink? And up until that time, I would always lie. I would always make excuse and try to flip the script and try to make her feel guilt for asking me and so on. But I broke down and I said, yes, I drank and I just can't do this anymore. I just don't know how. I'm lost. I need help. And I think also how she responded was, I think she felt my my honesty, my loss, or whatever the case. And she said, I know that you're trying. I know that you really want this, and we're going to do this together. I have your back. And and then give me goosebumps just thinking about that now. And, and at that point, talking about the turning point, that was really the turning point, because I got that peace immediately. And then I just kind of knew, okay, this is it. And then the next morning I start working on it, and never looked back, because I think that was the moment where I,
I was thinking kind of the same thing, where, you know, your wife was able to kind of get around that shame.
Yeah.
And you felt a little bit of, I'm trying to think for the right word. I know what you're trying to say too, but that you felt like a little bit of relief, it sounds like. And that gave you the courage to move forward and really start to take the actions, instead of being mired down in the shame and defensiveness of admitting to yourself. I mean, I guess that goes back to that acceptance piece.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. You're exactly right. I just really accept that point. I think I was being truly vulnerable, truly open, and having that reciprocate and that love, that support, that to me was really amazing, especially from someone, our daughter, she's 13 now, and she read my book. I gave it to her. And after she read, she came down and Laura and I were in the kitchen, and she says, "Mom, how come you didn't leave Pai?" You know, she calls me Pai, is that in Portuguese. She said, "How come you didn't leave Pai?" And that is so true. I asked that myself. I mean, if it was reverse, I don't know, right? If I would have the strength, the courage, the determination to do what she did, and for her to put up with that for so many years, that uncertainty, seeing your loved one change in front of you and not really understand what's happening. Yeah, that is, I'm really, really, really fortunate that if it wasn't for that, right, it would be in a different story. Definitely be dead by now.
And I think you bring up such an important point, which is being able to move out of the selfishness of addiction and into like what you're doing right now, which is that empathetic state. I mean, I think so much when we're in that addictive process, it's just all about, like you said earlier, how do I get the drink and or the drug or the behavior that makes me feel better? And we don't think about the impact it has on the people we love us, except, you know, I guess we have those moments where you recognized yourself in your father and you said, this can't be.
Yeah. Yeah, you're exactly right. Because it's, I don't know if you can relate to this, but as the disease evolved, you know, so did my ability to justify and almost like growing, right? We almost fed each other in that journey, the disease and myself. And thankfully, I had these enough kind of opportunities to have some sort of awakenings that I think it may have caught me the right time or whatever, where you have that little window of opportunity where you say, well, perhaps I should be paying attention. And I never forget, like years ago, George W. Bush was, I think it was in an Oprah show, and, you know, he had his problems with cocaine and so on, drinking too, I believe. And, and then he said, hey, my love for, I think he said alcohol at the time, or was greater than my love for my family. And that's something that always stuck with me. And I could relate to that, because to your point, you start putting alcohol in front of everything and everyone. And you start like lying becomes your second nature. You start planning everything to your point where you are not thinking about the impact that not only, of course, has to yourself, but to the others around you and those that you love.
Yeah. And it's hard to see that, but I think it's also great that, you know, like you gave your book to your daughter for her to be able to see that and that growth and redemption and, you know, the ability to change. What a gift. So shifting a little bit here, you talk about some pillars in your book that you found were really important in your recovery. And I want to talk a little bit about those as well. I know you go into more detail in your book, but can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure, of course. Yeah, as I found when I was looking back through my journey, I start reflecting on what are those things that really, I think, help me stay in the course of sobriety, because it's not always easy, and especially early on in the beginning, to me, it was very, very hard. But when thinking about it, you know, reflecting on the community that I had, and not only my family, but also creating meaningful connections, because what I realized, my experience when I was in the deep part of my addiction, I was so alone, so alone. I always knew a lot of people. I have a lot of connections, but when I really looked, I was lonely. I didn't have those deep connections anymore. So being able to reestablish those connections, either new or people that you have in your life, that is amazing. Then also finding ways to always continue to evolve. So one thing that I always struggle with meditation, and kind of it's hard for me to sit still, but I found something that like a daily positive affirmations that I do every morning. So it's a quick 10 minutes. Every day is the same things that I say and repeat. But it's amazing. The few times that I don't do it, I feel a big difference, right? So just finding what is that works for you, that recharges you, that fulfills you and helps you to improve and become aware. And so it could be physical, could be, you know, anything that regards. And then another one as well is, for example, is the acceptance and the self-honesty. To me, if you don't, you know, at least for me, I can't see an addict successfully staying sober long-term, hopefully forever, if that's not there. Because to me, that's kind of the absolutely one of the foundations. So that is something that I'm very mindful of, trying to find those pillars that allows me to your point, is a journey. It's not perfect. You make mistakes. And I think it's just kind of help put things into perspective and realize that no matter how bad a situation may be or at that moment, there's not enough of a reason to bring you back to that previous life.
Yeah. And to have that structure in front of you, because it's so easy to fall back into that thinking that doesn't help you. Tell me a little bit about taking your story and writing about it and putting it out there. And, you know, I'm still kind of going back to, you know, sharing it with your daughter and just being so vulnerable. Yeah. And writing it and making that decision to write it and put your story out there.
Yeah. 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 That has been a journey too. So the first 6 or 7 years, I really didn't share much. Very few people knew. And that goes back to my shame, my self-bias and all that. And then the few times that I start sharing, either in a mostly opportunistic way, you start seeing very positive reaction from people, meaning that almost every time I opened up to someone before I really became public with it, the response was either they were directly or indirectly impacted by it.
Yeah.
Okay. And that to me was like, I knew that there was a lot of people like myself out there, but I didn't know that was that many. And then even when people quite didn't have the directly experience with addiction or alcohol or drugs, still the stories somehow can be relate to some degree to health or some other challenges in their lives that there's some sort of relation to. So that was just like the addiction, we began growing, and then I start opening more, right, opening more, and receiving that feedback. I said, wow, that I and my wife Laura saying, hey, you know, someone helped you, you gotta do that. And I think that continued to evolve. And then when I became 8 years sober, the only social media that I did at the time is LinkedIn. I'm trying to grow more into others. And I posted, I just said, oh, I'm going to go all in. And I did.
Take the risk. Just take the risk and put it out there.
Exactly. Put it out there. And the response was unbelievable. And again, heard from so many people that I knew, that I worked with, that were going through the same things that I had no idea. Just goes into how the hiding is so good. People that are going for the same thing when I was going through it. And then people within, you know, my son, my daughter, my partner, and that just kind of exploded. And then it really gave me the peace of mind that, wow, I really have the opportunity to make a difference. So, and how I say to your question on, I guess, how I became comfortable or had the courage to open up and really put it out there is that I believe that my purpose to help others became greater than the fear of any backlash.
Yeah.
And you know, Duane, and it's interesting. And I think, you know, my daughter, I was always a little bit open. She never really knew the entire story until she read the book. But she's seen some of podcasts and things that I've done, and she was very proud and very thankful that I decided to get help and change. But it was interesting that sometimes the exterior perceptions that we have of people, if someone was looking into my life, okay, and they had no really closeness to what I was going through, they would imagine, man, this guy has a perfect life.
Right.
He has no problems. He's has a good career. You know, he has a beautiful family. He looks healthy and so on. And I think that's why I wanted to also to get out there, because, you know, even my own self bias is like, hey, you know, if someone is homeless, well, okay, he or she may have been an addict, and then that explains. But if someone is successful or whatever, then that doesn't apply. And I wanted to help break that and open up, because to me, that's part of why it's still so much issue with sharing information about this, because there's so much shame that unless people like myself feel comfortable of talking openly, that will not change.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, so many people suffer in silence. You know, they're the majority of people who struggle with addiction, just from a look from the outside, you wouldn't even know.
Yeah.
Yet in the inside, like you said, you know, you can have all of these outside things that look wonderful, but be suffering on the inside in that darkness. Like you said in your book, you know, part of you just slowly disappeared.
Yeah.
As this addiction took over, and it was, you were an empty shell. Yet no one would know, because, you know, you, like you said, you have all the things that make everything look great, but internally you're suffering. I mean, that's to all the people out there that are in your position. I mean, there's hope. I mean, by you doing that, it removes a little bit of this shame for them, and maybe they can say something like, oh, maybe I should get some support here.
Yes. And I think that's part of that, is because when you're in that state, you feel so lonely, you don't see a way out. You don't think people will understand you. And I had a great support system. So yeah. I can imagine if someone that may be, I don't know, maybe alone or may not have people that are so understanding or supportive because of very hard disease to be around. But yeah, you said it brilliantly. I want to make sure that help people understand that, hey, they're not alone, number one. There's so many people out there and you don't have to go through this alone if you don't want to. And also, it's not your fault. It's not people's fault. And that's one thing that I still don't know, Duane. Perhaps you can help me. I caught one of your shows actually a year ago, in March of last year with Dr. Higgins.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So I connected with her. We actually became friends and did her biomarkers. Because to your point, I still don't know. Like, I know that DNA, I have DNA and all that. But there's still, I think, a little bit of a gray scenario on how much choice, how much of your behaviors plays into that. But, and I think that's part of the shame and the lack of understanding about the disease is because you're never like, okay, this is 100% as to why you, Caesar, became an addict. And, you know, there's this bunch of things that tells me why I was very likely and how I got there.
Yeah.
But it doesn't say this is exactly why. But like, as I said on the books, like, I don't know any addict that wants to be an addict.
Yeah, me neither.
Yeah.
Me neither. I mean, I've worked in this field a long time. Yeah. I think some people have given up hope. And that's very sad where they give up. But yeah, I agree with you. Everybody wants out. And going back to that other piece of it, we're complex, right? We're an amalgamation of all of our biology, our experiences, our genetics, our psychology, and then it all comes together. And I don't know if anyone could find the perfect answer because I think it's all of these pieces. But the more we put these pieces together, the more we take this information, I think the more hope we have to be able to make strategic change to get through addiction and to overcome it. And all of that plays in. We may never find the perfect answer to that, but I don't know if we need to.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, I'm there with you. I think as long as we can, you know, open the conversation, provide people with options and support because, right, different type of treatments, different type of options speak to different people. And as long as we make all them available to everyone, that is a big step to helping.
Totally. So, okay. So we're running on our time here. You know, I like to ask like the one question at the end, and that's someone out there struggling and you could tell them one thing. What do you want them to know? What do you want to tell them?
I want to tell that there is hope. There is hope. It doesn't matter how unlikely it is, how hard and how dark the situation they are in might be. There is definitely a way out. It's not easy. It's not easy, but there is available resources. There are people happy to help anyone. I'm not a professional, but you know, like you, I'm an expert on my own journey, you know, and you don't got to feel ashamed. It's to your point, it's not a one decision or a choice that someone made. It's a complex reason as to why each of one of us got where we were. But, you know, it's not your fault. You can remove that guilt and hopefully that will open up the door to start seeing the light at the end of the tunnel there.
Yeah. New possibilities. And there's your book. If you relate to Caesar, get his book, hear his story, and find your way out. With that, how can people find you? Where do they go?
Yeah. Yeah. So a few things. I'm on LinkedIn. It's really easy. My name is pretty unique. So Caesar Vorm, you just type there, you're going to see is only one out there. Right. Also on my website, caesarvorm.com, all together. And you can find information about the books and blogs that I do and unrelated to addiction at times. And then, as I said, I'm building a little bit of my other social media exposure as well in Instagram and Facebook.
Awesome. I will put all the links in the show notes at theaddictedmind.com. So you can check it out. You get a link to Caesar's book as well and read his story. I think you all will really enjoy it and getting a lot out of it. It's just an honest story of the desire to change, the desire to be better. And so thank you, Caesar, for coming on to the Addicted Mind podcast, sharing your story and just being here and being yourself.
Thank you. It was an honor and privilege. So thank you so much and keep up the awesome work, Dwayne. Thank you.
All right, everyone. Thank you for listening to the Addicted Mind podcast. As usual, all the show notes will be at theaddictedmind.com. So check them out there. And if you'd like to continue the conversation online, join our Facebook group. Just go to Facebook, type in the Addicted Mind podcast and click join. And if you're getting a lot out of this podcast, you can leave us a 5-star review. And if you're really enjoying it, you can write us a review. That would be awesome in whatever podcast app you're using right now. Thank you all who have done that. I truly appreciate it. All right, everyone, have a wonderful day, and I will talk to you on the next episode.
It's easy to blame ourselves for our struggles with alcohol. We see people around us being able to control their drinking without any consequences, yet no matter what we try, we can't seem to figure it out for ourselves. My name is Jillian Teets, and I am the host of the Sober Powered podcast, where I use my biochemistry background to explain the latest research in addiction and help you understand both why you drink the way you do and how to develop the skills and mindset you need to find freedom from alcohol. I discuss topics like why we think about our drinking 24/7, why we have no off switch, and why we crave alcohol. If you're struggling with your drinking or you know someone who is, then I hope that you will check out the Sober Powered podcast. New episodes every Friday. See you there.